talking history. This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Egan. In tonight's show, we're debating the life and legacy of the hero of two worlds, Giuseppe Garibaldi. And we'll be finding out how he helped unify Italy and became an international icon in the 19th century. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just send us a text, 53106. Text costs 30 cents. Or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we discussed whether battles are overrated in deciding the outcome of wars in our monthly book show. And 2 weeks ago, we explored what life was like in ancient Rome. And if you want to listen back to that or to any of our shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or go directly to iTunes. Tonight's show is on Giuseppe Garibaldi. Born Joseph Mary Garibaldi in Nice in 1807, Garibaldi became known as the hero of two worlds because of his involvement in various struggles for independence around the world. In the 1830s, he played a major role in the Brazilian struggle for independence, while in the 1840s, he fought in the Civil War in Uruguay. He returned to the Italian states in 1848, where he defended the short-lived Roman Republic. Forced into exile, he moved to the United States and from there to Central America and Britain before travelling to Genoa in 1854. When the Second Italian War of Independence began, he was appointed a major general and raised 1,000 volunteers, popularly known as the Red Shirts, who sailed to Sicily in May 1860 and won a series of dramatic victories. Having conquered Sicily, he moved on to Naples and, after a major battle, handed over his gains to Victor Emmanuel II. During the American Civil War, Abraham Lincoln tried to persuade him to fight for the Union side, but he refused unless slavery was to be abolished. Opposed to the principle of the Papal States, he moved against Rome in 1862 and fought against the Austrians in 1866 before spending his final days in retirement as a farmer, and Garibaldi died in 1882. An international freedom fighter and one of the most famous and loved men of the 19th century, he is credited with helping to make Italian unification possible in 1870. And in tonight's show, we want to explore his life, his legacy, and his legend. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Enrico Dal Lago is head of the School of History and Philosophy at NUI Galway and is an expert in 19th century American and Italian history, as well as the subject of slavery. And his books include Civil War and Agrarian Unrest, The Confederate South and Southern Italy. Professor Raymond Grew is Professor of History Emeritus at the University of Michigan, an expert on the social history of France and Italy. He has written extensively on the Risorgimento. Professor John A. Davis is Professor of Modern Italian History at the University of Connecticut, an expert on Italian history since 1700. He's the general editor of the 7-volume Oxford Short History of Italy, and his books include the award-winning Naples and Napoleon, Southern Italy and the European Revolutions, 1780 to 1860. Well, you're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Professor Lucy Ryle, Professor of Comparative History at the European University Institute in Florence. She's written extensively on 19th and 20th century Italian history, including the wonderful biography Garibaldi, Invention of a Hero. And John, we might begin with you. And I might begin by posing one of those big, tough questions, which is whether Italy would have been unified without Garibaldi.
Yes, well, that is a big question, isn't it? I think the answer has to be it probably would have happened, but Garibaldi's part in it was extremely important, and historians, and I suppose that's one of the reasons why we're having this panel, are still trying to work out what his contribution is. It goes from, the scale goes from crediting him with having single-handed brought about unification. Obviously, that wasn't the case. And it goes at the other end to sort of writing him off, not as a footnote, but as one amongst many other players. As usual, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. But I think, again, one of the big problems that we'd be discussing this evening is actually distinguishing between Garibaldi, the historical figure, on one hand, and Garibaldi, the myth, on the other.
Alan Riga, that really is the challenge in tonight's show, distinguishing between the myth and the historical reality. And what's extraordinary about Garibaldi is that he's a figure who we wouldn't be able to cover in a single show if we tried to deal with this chronologically. There's just too much in that life that we have to deal with it thematically, and we have to jump around the career and look at the life and the legend. And what's extraordinary is the fact that this isn't just an Italian historical subject that we're discussing tonight. This is a global icon.
That's absolutely true. And it's so true that there were even Russian students who talked about Garibaldi and were considered conspiratorial in the 19th century because his fame had gone as far as that. But probably the most important episode that shows that he was really a global icon is related to him in his involvement in the American Civil War. First of all, there was a 39th New York Volunteers, which was called Garibaldi Guard in his honor from the very start of the American Civil War, and it gathered Czechs, Hungarians, and Italians under the banner of the Union. But then, as you mentioned briefly, Lincoln offered him some kind of command in the Union Army. And it was it's a very complicated story, what happened in reality on the ground when Lincoln offered him this army. But it was on foot of his extraordinary exploits as unificator of Italy in 1860. He was such a major figure of general that to get him to join the Union Army and to become a commander in the American Civil War would have been an incredible scoop for the Union. So Lincoln sent Henry Shelton Sanford, who was both his plenipotentiary in Belgium and part of the Secret Service of the Union, to see if Garibaldi would have accepted. And Garibaldi, as you said briefly, did not accept because at the moment, in August 1861, the Union wasn't fighting to eliminate slavery, to emancipate the slaves, and Lincoln was known as a fighter for freedom. Then there were other talks in 1862 after the Factet Aspromonte, when Garibaldi tried to redo the trail that had brought him to conquer Naples, to conquer Rome this time, and he was wounded and shot by the Italian army in order to not upset the French. And so when this happened, he became even more of a global icon. And the fact that he was so famous led to a reversal in the American Civil War itself, because effectively there were riots in England among Republicans who supported Garibaldi, and there was a growing support for the Union because Garibaldi had started saying that he would have supported the war that the Union was fighting against the Confederacy, because now it was clear to him that it was a war against slavery. So he helped enormously the cause of the Union, and because of his global fame, his global appeal to so many different people around the world.
John, when I was studying Garibaldi for this show, I thought it would make a great multi-part television series. But then I thought that if this was something that I was watching on television or on Netflix or something like that, I just wouldn't believe it. I wouldn't believe that someone was a military general, but also they ended up on various occasions becoming a sea admiral. I wouldn't believe that after these exploits, he ended up working as a candle maker in New York. And the aspects that Enrico was mentioning there about his popularity during the American Civil War, there's too much in the life to unpick that if I was seeing it on television, I would stop watching because I wouldn't believe it.
Yes, I mean, it is an extraordinary life. At the same time, you know, in that period, now the 19th century, this was a time at which there were many Europeans, not just Italians, who were moving around different parts of Europe, North America, South America. A lot of people were political exiles. You know, after the end of the Napoleonic Wars, for example, a lot of military, naval people were laid off. They didn't have jobs, and they finished up. I mean, there were so many wars, minor wars, mainly civil wars, both in Europe and in the Americas, that there was plenty of employment for people like this. Now, Garibaldi, of course, was actually a sailor. He didn't start as a soldier, but then once he learned his trade as a guerrilla leader in Latin America, then because of what was happening back in Europe, he found actually that he was going to be able to find employment, but it was very insecure. And after his great triumph in 1849, the defense of the Roman Republic, as you say, he finishes up making candles in Staten Island.
Yeah, it really is an extraordinary story. Raymond, you're very welcome, first of all, to the show. And
thank you.
I'd love to ask you about how Garibaldi engaged with the wider public, because image seems to have been very important for him. I sometimes think that he would have thrived in the 21st century. And he, I won't call it necessarily propaganda, but he was very skillful in the use of his image.
Well, he was, and it was a very important part of his whole approach. he was sensitive to propaganda. He was very sensitive to public opinion and was eager to mobilize it. And that's one of the really modern parts of his whole persona. And I think, in a way, when we're impressed with the variety of his activities and stands, and even their inconsistency, we need also to be impressed with the modern sensibility, his gift for appealing to the, a mass public, his ability to get along with the aristocracy. He wasn't always consistent, but he was always sensitive to public opinion, public feeling, believed in progress, believed in the current drift of politics, and that made him very effective.
Very interesting. Enrico, the name, the hero of two worlds that he had, it's a dimension to his life that I was surprised by. I always knew him as the hero of Italian unification and his great campaigns with the red shirts. But there was a whole extra career in Argentina, in Brazil, in Uruguay, that is this extraordinary part of the Garibaldi legend.
Yes, and it's interesting to notice that he was only one of two men who received this expression, this nickname, the hero of two worlds. The first one was the Marquis de Lafayette, who had fought both in the American and in the French revolutions. So it was an incredible honor to be bestowed upon with this nickname. And it came really from the fact that before fighting for Italian unification, he fought for other wars in South America. Now, the most important probably was the Farroupilha War, which was a war of the Republic of the Rio Grande do Sul against the Brazilian Empire. It was a war that was fought by large cattle owners and landowners, but it was constructed as a major feat of Republican freedom against an empire, and therefore an autocratic type of government. So there, Garibaldi honed his skills as a guerrilla fighter, and he also acquired his fame as a national, as a liberator of nation and oppressed people. And then he went to Uruguay in the 1840s, and he fought for the Republic of Uruguay against Argentine dictator Juan Manuel de Rosas. So again, another war in which he was pitting himself for national freedom against oppression by an autocratic regime. And therefore it was all consistent with this idea that not only was a hero of two worlds, but he was a democratic and republican and freedom fighter hero of two worlds.
Raymond, is it possible to assess his what his political beliefs were? What was it that motivated this young man who had been born in Nice to become a major figure in the campaign for Italian unification, to become a harsh opponent of slavery, to become a liberator of all these countries fighting for their freedom?
He had a very optimistic and progressist view of politics and of the direction that world affairs was going to take, and thought he could take advantage of it and be a natural leader in it. He was not always consistent. It wasn't important to him to follow procedures, for example. He could be quite arbitrary, but his confidence in himself as a leader and in himself as a spokesman for the direction of history was an absolutely enormous strength. And he was ready to seize an opportunity in any situation to lead forces for causes he considered progressive, and included fighting for the French in the Franco-Prussian War.
Very good. John, I'm not quite understanding what was the key ingredient to his success. Was it that he had a brilliant military mind, or was it something to do with his charisma and personality that inspired people to follow him and fight for him, and that was that was the secret of his greatness?
Well, I think, you know, to answer that question, we really need to go back to an earlier point made by my good friend Ray Grew, when he underlined the modernity of Garibaldi's whole persona. Because, you know, what's become clear from the studies that have been done on Garibaldi over the last couple of decades is that he was a key figure in a group. He had a lot of people working with him, and really the key persona was Giuseppe Mazzini. Now, Mazzini was the thinker. Mazzini was a political exile in London in the 1840s. And it was Mazzini who was looking to Mazzini understood that as a nationalist, he didn't have an army, he didn't have anything. He needed to find outside support for the cause of Italian independence. Now, words are actually, you know, really important here, because we talk about Italian independence, Italian unification, because we know what the outcome of the story was. At the time, and above all in the Anglo-Saxon world, people talked about Italian emancipation. It was something that was seen very much in the same terms as the emancipation of slaves and so on, because for most Protestant Anglo-Saxons, the Italians were slaves to Roman Catholicism and the papacy. So they saw this struggle as a struggle for religious freedom, in fact. Now, Mazzini didn't want to buy into that, but he did want to find support. And he understood that Garibaldi was a figure, particularly after the defense of the Roman Republic, who could actually be used as a vehicle for generating this support. And it's Mazzini who, in the early part of Mazzini's career, organizes his first trip to England. It was Mazzini who organized his first trip to New York in 1851. Mazzini is always there. The relationship between the two of them was always difficult, and Mazzini always insisted to others around him, Garibaldi is weak. we've got to keep tabs on him. We've got to keep him under our thumbs. So what I'm saying is that, you know, it's very difficult to think of Garibaldi as this sort of prima donna figure who is running the show. He was certainly a key player. His military skills were one of his assets, but by no means the only one, as Lucy Ryle has shown, you know, so well. He just fitted the model of a blonde, white, European hero so well that he was very marketable. And all these things sort of come together around that figure. But without Mazzini and without the networks that Mazzini had, because, you know, Garibaldi in his whole career never raised a single euro in cash. That was Mazzini's job. And the networks that Mazzini created, that was where the money came from. Because however radical you might want to be, you can't have a revolution unless you can raise funds to finance it.
Excellent. We've had a text in from Alistair in Fox Rock, who's a very happy Liverpool fan because they won yesterday and Manchester City lost today. But he has a football-related question, and that's something that he had read, that Nottingham Forest, a club that was founded in 1865, chose the colour red for their shirts because they wanted to honour Garibaldi. And that indeed is something that I came across during it. Enrico, it's extraordinary. It shows the global impact of Garibaldi, that a football team becomes famous and has its red shirts, and it's inspired by this revolutionary.
Yes, and it is again something else that relates to the idea of hero two worlds, because the red shirts are born, in fact, in Uruguay, in the war that Garibaldi and the Uruguayan Republic fight against Argentine dictator Juan Manuel de Rosas. Garibaldi, in 1843, forms an Italian legion with the Italian immigrants in Montevideo and surroundings. It's just a few hundred people. And then in order to find something that distinguishes them, he decides to take hold of a series of uniforms that were worn by the workers in the slaughterhouses to cover the blood, and therefore they were red uniforms. And this becomes the emblem of the Italian Legion, which is also important because it's an emblem that is related to very symbolic meaning. The red in the 19th century is also the color of republicanism, and therefore it means revolution wherever it goes. So the red shirts are by definition revolutionaries, and Garibaldi himself is known as El Diablo in South America, the devil. So he constructs this fame which sees that it's very powerful in iconic terms, that follows him wherever he goes, and the red shirts will continue to be his main way of conducting war in iconic terms.
Well, he knew about image and he knew about becoming an icon. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be talking to Professor Lucy Ryle about Garibaldi, the invention of a hero.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life and legacy of Garibaldi. I'm delighted to be joined on the phone by Professor Lucy Ryle, Professor of Comparative History at the European University Institute in Florence. She's written extensively on 19th and 20th century Italian history, including the brilliant biography Garibaldi, The Invention of a Hero. Lucy, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Patrick. It's a pleasure to be here.
Garibaldi seems to have become something of a global icon after the events of 1860. I'm wondering how much of that was deserved, and how much of it was based on reality, and how much of it was myth-making?
Well, I think the most important thing to say that it's very difficult to distinguish between sort of deserved and reality on the one hand, and myth-making on the other. He did have some amazing achievements. I mean, the unification of Italy in particular, but also his activities in the 1848-49 revolutions, they were extraordinary achievements. He showed extraordinary bravery. He was an incredible leader of men in a period when soldiers really were extraordinary heroes. So I don't think we necessarily have to say that sort of Garibaldi wasn't a hero, but I think what we need to understand is that he was also constructed. He was constructed in part by nationalists around him, by his supporters, but then he was constructed also through the press, and through particularly through kind of favorable articles about him, and through images showing him. He was an extraordinary looking man. So he's one of the first media heroes, really, and in that sense is a very important figure to understanding kind of present issues of how politics is mediated through and affected by the media.
And he seems to have played up to that himself. In a way, he seems to have known what he was doing.
Yes, that's one of the remarkable things about him, because he doesn't ever, you know, in his writings, reflect upon this. So it's quite difficult to analyse it, because it seemed to, on one level, seem to have come very naturally to him. One of these people that sort of knows, if you like, how to manipulate a crowd, knows how to make a speech at the right time. So people were very captivated by him, and some of it is kind of deliberate in the sense that you can see him adjusting what he does and what he says and even how he looks for a particular situation or a particular audience. But then, you know, some of it is a kind of just, it is really just a natural talent as far as I can tell.
There seems to be a split, though, a divide between those who admire his legacy and those who are supportive of it, that his legacy seems to become divisive in the years afterwards.
His legacy is divisive even, you know, during his lifetime. I think there are people who literally, you know, adore him. I mean, if you read some of the letters and comments of ordinary people that come into contact with him, or you just read about him, they're kind of in love with him. They have a very emotional response. And then there are those who really don't like him at all, have actually really, you know, hate him. I mean, some of the letters that I've looked at in the archives sent by ordinary people saying, you know, you're an evil man, you've done a lot of damage, you know, you've really ruined the world. And then, of course, the right, the conservatives, and above all the Catholic Church, they really, really see him as the kind of prime enemy, because one of Garibaldi's enemies is the Catholic Church. He's very, very against anything to do with priests and the Catholic hierarchy. So there's that. But then on the other hand, and this gets this sort of happens even, as I say, when he's alive, as he gets older, and then most of all after his death, there is a kind of squabble between the left on the one hand, sort of socialists on the one hand, Republicans, and then the monarchy on the other, to control his legacy. So there's also a sort of discussion and rivalry about who owns Garibaldi's legacy.
What about someone like Mussolini? You could see him admiring and seeing much to admire in the story of Garibaldi.
Yeah, I mean, that's really one of the more problematic things about him, in the sense that, you know, once he's got this political style out there, if you like, once he's got this kind of image of a strong, vigorous, because that's one of the words they sort of use, energetic man who doesn't actually like the kind of nitty-gritty of politics and uses very strong emotive language, lots of different people can use it. And one of the things that Mussolini claims to do is to have fulfilled Garibaldi's legacy. So sort of all the things that frustrated Garibaldi in his lifetime, Mussolini has actually inherited that and sorted the problems out. But that doesn't mean that Garibaldi was an early fascist. It just means that it really is quite difficult, once you've put that kind of popular politics out there, to control what happens to it.
I see that a few years ago you wrote an article on the sex lives of Italian patriots, and given that Garibaldi is, as you say, seen as this vigorous figure, he's seen as sexually attractive and charismatic and so on, was that an element of the story that also intrigued people?
I think so. I mean, it's difficult, you know, because one of the things that's difficult for us to understand is partly his attraction, because, you know, the look changes completely, but also 19th century people are much more circumspect about sex than we are. So you can't really, unfortunately, quite tell what's going on. But he has a very powerful effect on women as well as men. And this is interesting, because it's a period when women are actually really excluded from politics. So he manages, kind of on one level in very important ways to bring women into politics, and women are very active in his movement. But at the same time, there's a sort of, I don't know, you might call it more dodgy aspect of his behavior, which is that he not just uses women in a way, but he also seems to have had an awful lot of female lovers. I'm not quite sure what else you could call them. I mean, my favorite story is the story of when he visits London in 1864, and he lives in the, he stays rather, in the Duke of Sutherland's house near Buckingham Palace. And from the letters that I discovered, he seduces both the Duke of Sutherland's wife and the Duke of Sutherland's mother, because they write him these extraordinary letters after he leaves. So, yeah, that aspect of, I mean, it's sort of normal for, and it's a normal, you know, thereafter, that politicians or male politicians use women in this way, but it's a more difficult side of Garibaldi's personal life, which for a long, long time was always kept under wraps.
And finally then, Lucy, how do you think history should remember him?
Well, that's a very interesting question, how history should remember Garibaldi, because there's always been a fight about how history should remember Garibaldi. To me, personally, I think what we should remember him, actually, for his bravery, and I don't just mean bravery in battle, but bravery as he gets older, and he could really have sort of relaxed and just been this kind of national icon, nationalist icon, and instead he carries on really right to his death to fight for things he believes in, like justice and social justice and political justice and improvement also for poorer people. So, he suffers a great deal. He's very ill towards the end of his life, and he's always out there fighting in one way or another, as I say, for social justice. So I think he's quite an admirable character in many ways, as well as being a very brave one.
Okay, well, my thanks to Professor Lucy Ryle, Professor of Comparative History at the European University Institute in Florence, author of the brilliant book Garibaldi, Invention of a Hero, and lots more besides. Lucy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on the legacy of Garibaldi right after this break.
Talking History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the life and legacy of Giuseppe Garibaldi. And we are joined by a really superb panel of experts tonight. Before the break there, I was joined to Professor Lucy Ryle. And we have, for this final part of the show, Professor Enrico Dal Lago, Professor Raymond Grew, and Professor John A. Davis. Some great texts coming in. Conan Ringsend on 53106 saying, "Hi, Patrick. Apropos nothing, I'm also a very happy Newcastle fan tonight. You are not the only one, Con." John in Glass Nevin is enjoying the programme, so that's always interesting, and thinks that Garibaldi is perhaps Italy's answer, if the opposite, of Daniel O'Connell. And what do I think? Well, certainly in terms of the use of image, I think opposition to slavery, campaigns, definitely some interesting connections there indeed. Raymond, I want to ask you about the personality of Garibaldi, because it's interesting when you look at him, he seems to have been a man of action, and I'm wondering how much of that was image and how much of that was his real personality.
I don't think you can separate the two. He did some stunning things and dramatic things. He was given to dramatic gestures, and so that was part of his very personality. At the same time, everything was less inevitable than it seemed. And I think one of the interesting odd facts is the degree to which we talk about Garibaldi now still in terms of sort of predictions of what he will do, what he will influence. We can't discuss it these days without allusions to the democratic right or the populist right. Talking about him in terms of fascism. And none of that is inevitable. He was quixotic. He shifted positions. He took advantage of opportunities. And in all of those ways, he was not a consistent political thinker, but he was an intuitive
responder, and he had a set of quite fixed principles that were important to him. So that there's a consistency there, but it isn't a political scientist sort of consistency. And I think that he still baffles us in some ways, and that's part of his fascination.
Very interesting indeed. Enrico, Lucy touched on maybe the charisma, the attractiveness of Garibaldi. He was married three times. He seems to have had a very interesting, if tangled, love life. How much do we know about his private life?
We know a lot about certain iconic things related to his private life, and a lot of it relate to his romantic marriage with Anita, who was his first wife. He met her when he was campaigning in Brazil, when she was just 19 years old, and he was in his 30s, and it was love at first sight, from what he says in his memoirs. And she was really somebody who followed him wherever he went in terms of participating in battles and making sure that she was always there fighting with him. And even their marriage life was the stuff of romance, because they were pursued by imperial troops. She was famously she fled a couple of times with a baby in her arms, and therefore it was really something that became the stuff of legend. And when then the last episode was when Garibaldi fled from the Roman Republic, as the Roman Republic fell, together with several of his followers, and he took Anita with him, and Anita was pregnant, and they arrived in the, this is a famous episode, in the Po area, and she was she fell with malaria, and she died in his arms. And this became the ultimate iconic moment of his private life, and it was sort of portrayed always in nationalistic terms. The general lost his wife for the cause, so he has made the ultimate sacrifice, and therefore you should make the same sacrifice for the same cause.
And he was shot and wounded in the leg, and the bullet became almost a holy relic.
Yes, in fact, the surgeon who actually managed to save his foot by extracting the bullet became a sort of hero in his own right. And the bands that were put around the foot became holy relics. And this because it was such an extraordinary icon. And after he was shot, he was in prison, because he had committed effectively an act of treason against the Italian government. He was put in prison in a castle in Liguria, and thousands of visitors came, and flowers and letters. It was impossible to actually keep the crowd away, and he became a cause célèbre because of this. He was in prison, but the Italian government was so much under pressure that they had to pardon him instead of executing him for treason, because it would have been the ultimate scandal. And therefore, this global icon fame increased enormously after this particular moment.
Very good. John, we could almost do an entire show on his later career in the 1860s. He went up against the Papal States, had, I think, two times in where he was imprisoned and then released. He had his involvement at the Paris Commune in 1871. And then ending up as a farmer. He had an extraordinary career even in those later years.
He did. But as Lucy Ryle was saying a few minutes ago, the later part of his career is sort of less spectacular. He carries on, but one of the problems for Garibaldi was, of course, that he had in the 1850s, he decided to throw in his lot with the King of Piedmont. And that was a deep, deep disappointment to many of his followers, who were Republicans, they were Democrats, And the, you know, the debate goes on now, still, in making this, concession, in deciding to go with the king of Piedmont. Was Garibaldi a realist? Was that the way? Was he a pragmatist? Was this the way of keeping a popular movement going, or had he sold out? And that's one of the great questions that all his biographers have been forced to address. But it sort of takes us back again to that distinction between Garibaldi, the person, the historical actor, and Garibaldi, the myth, because it's not surprising, really, that the myth kind of runs out after Italy's been unified. Because, you know, what happens then after that is much more a matter of domestic Italian politics. It doesn't concern other people. And the reasons that had drawn him to the attention of the world outside Italy before 1870, I mean, they've also changed too. I mean, this is, again, you know, everything in history is so much about particular context of time and place. There was we've talked a lot about this evening about Garibaldi as a global icon. And I think perhaps we need to question that concept a bit, because he did have this huge reputation. But when you get down to it, there was one image of Garibaldi in France, one image of Garibaldi in Spain, another in Britain, well, especially in England and in Wales, another in Ireland, another in the United States. And he's the figure linking all of these, but all those images are very, very different. You know, when he went to New York in 1851, he was going to have a big public celebration in the city. But because of the organization of supporters of Pope Pius IX and the first Catholic Archbishop of New York, Bishop Richard Hughes, that was cancelled, and Garibaldi left the city, and he was dissuaded from making any public addresses at all because, you know, his presence was divisive. And I think that when you get down to it, in so many cases, Garibaldi's image became, in those years, a sort of proxy battleground for a whole lot of different domestic politics. They were different in England, different in Ireland, different in the United States.
Very interesting indeed. Raymond, when we discuss the legacy of Garibaldi, is the real legacy the way he conquered the south of Italy and helped pave the way for Italian unification?
I suppose ultimately that is the most prominent achievement. On the other hand, the myth of a powerful leader, of a man who can make history independent of other forces, in an era in which there was much talk about the inevitability of history or the great man's role in history, Garibaldi played to that as well. And so his legacy is difficult to pin down because he had so much appeal that was, in fact, quite genuine and related very much to a personality that was made to play an international starring role in the public at a time when the public was becoming more important than it had ever been in politics.
Okay, well, I think that's a brilliant note on which to end our discussion on Garibaldi. As we've looked at the life, we've looked at the legacy, but we've also explored the legend and tried to dig deep down into what it actually represented. An absolutely brilliant panel of experts, Professor Enrico Del Lago, Professor Raymond Grew, Professor John A. Davis, and earlier we heard from Professor Lucy Ryle. That does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we're looking at the history of the Khmer Rouge as we find out about the killing fields of Cambodia. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.